Let's hang around a bit in the Grand Rapids of 1900, a thriving and interesting little town as we've seen it develop. And we can do that in the company of Lawrence Rossman, editor, publisher of the Grand Rapids Herald Review, through his local history columns that he wrote in the 1930s and 40s. Here's a glance at a very important and significant service that was widely available in Grand Rapids in 1900. Rossman writes, "Clearing the corner where the new post office building is to be constructed reminds older citizens of the community of an important change in business in the past generation. Part of the site was once covered by a livery barn. Most people accept a livery barn as a thing with which all people are familiar, but the truth is that only those who are 20 or more years of age have any remembrance at all of that very useful and interesting institution. There are many people in Grand Rapids who have never seen a buckboard to which was attached a spanking pair of horses. Even buggies and surreys are vehicles that are seldom seen except on display as curiosities. Before the days of the automobile, there were at least a half dozen livery stables in Grand Rapids." Imagine that, a half dozen of them. "Every hotel or stopping place had one next to it or near to it. In the later days of the horse-drawn vehicles, the number of stables declined, but horses and the vehicles which they drew were always essential to the conduct of business. Coming back to the post office site, the livery stable there was built at about the turn of the century by Daniel Doran. After he had owned it for a while, it was purchased by another who had it for 9 years, and about 1911, the barn was purchased by Clarence Buchanan. A good livery team could cover up to 50 miles a day. That was too long a drive, though sometimes even greater mileage was made. But most teams were restricted to about 30 or 35 miles a day." Well, that's a lot of distance. Those horses certainly really had to work hard, huh? "The distance always depended upon the roads, which were limited in number. There was the highway up the prairie, a road to Cohasset, and possibilities of journeys along the Mississippi. Gradually, the highway miles, consisting largely of trails through the woods, were expanded until a team and buckboard could go many places. Long journeys were seldom made, especially after the railroads were built. The longest trip generally made was from Grand Rapids to Big Fork. The fee for a livery team was generally $4 a day. If a driver was furnished, that was additional, according to the going wages. A livery barn required a good-sized investment. The barn had to be owned or rented. Clarence Buchanan had 20 good driving horses. These varied in price, but they were always valuable. There was a large investment in harness and vehicles, and a barn and its animals and equipment ran into many thousands of dollars. These old centers of local transportation were very busy places. A livery barn was always filled with many hands attending to the valet duties essential to a good driving horse. Any spare time was put in oiling harnesses. In the front and southeast corner of the Buchanan barn was the office, which was always open. It was filled with blankets, foot warmers, and other necessities. There was always a place for a man to sleep, for someone must be on hand at all times to protect the property against the constant danger of fire and to serve those who needed horses at all hours of night or day. A livery stable was also an interesting meeting place for many citizens. In every community, there were a certain number of people who had great interest in horses. They hung around. A livery barn was always attractive to a boy. In many communities, it was a well-known visiting place where politics and such were discussed. While the automobile has led to garages and plenty of filling stations, it had its immediate effect on the livery barn. This institution rapidly faded into the past. That began to happen in Grand Rapids about 1912. At that time, roads were built to principal points to accommodate the early automobiles of the community. Clarence Buchanan saw the change coming, and in 1913 he began to serve some of his customers with an overland automobile. For some time that was a difficult task. cars were always getting stuck, and it was nothing for an automobile and its passengers to spend the night in a mud hole. Very often it was necessary to take a farmer away from his work for half a day to pull a car out of that mud. Soon, however, both cars and roads were greatly improved. The development of the new form of transportation completely ruined the livery business. Mr. Buchanan sold the barn, and it was used as a sales stable. One day a fire broke out, and what was left of the old red structure was torn down. So, yeah, those livery barns very much a part of life for a long time, and what a major transition from horses to automobiles. What a change in conditions that certainly was. Russman introduces us to a very well-known figure in the Grand Rapids of 1900. He writes, "In some of the frontier towns, there was good eating for many people at very low prices. Grand Rapids had several good restaurants, but the most famous one of all was that operated by Dave Chambers, a gentleman of color who was always referred to in town as Nigger Dave. This famous cook came to Grand Rapids in the early days of the community. He lived in town for over 15 years, and he died in Grand Rapids. He was not only a good cook, but probably during most of the time, he was the only Negro in the entire county or area. Being a good-natured man, he got along well with everyone." I'm looking at a picture of him from the Itasca County Historical Society. And, very pleasant-looking man, pleasant smile on his face. Very well-dressed. He's wearing a long, double-breasted overcoat and a Homburg hat, and he looks very contented with matters. Over the years, Dave's restaurants were in several locations in town. Some of the time, he was in the back end of a saloon. Those were days when most saloons either served free lunches to their thirsty and hungry customers, or they had a restaurant attached to the saloon where those who drank might easily eat. Because women were not allowed around saloons in those early days, Dave's customers were predominantly men. He cooked for men. He cooked for lumberjacks. He cooked for traveling men, of which there were many in those early times. The regular price of a meal at Dave's was 25 cents. The meal began with soup. There would be good meat. There would be plenty of fried potatoes and excellent pie. A special steak dinner might cost a half dollar. In his cookery, Dave had many things that are not common today. For instance, he could easily get moose and venison. There were ducks to be obtained in the fall, and always partridge. Wild rice cost but a few cents a pound. The menu would tend largely towards the staples of meat, potatoes, and pie, without salads and ice cream. Dave brought with him many of the cooking customs of the South. He served many things which are cooked below the Mason-Dixon line. One of the things which he would do was to prepare turtle soup. Out behind the restaurant, he'd put a great big barrel. In it, he would dump the swill from his restaurant until the barrel was well filled. Then Dave would let it be known that he wished a big turtle. Someone would go out to a nearby stream or lake and come into Dave's carrying an enormous snapping turtle. This would go into the barrel where it would live in peace and contentment for several weeks. Then it would be slaughtered and made into soup. Word would spread around town that Dave would have turtle soup, and the lumberjacks, traveling men, and citizens of the community would flock in, usually late at night, to eat some of Dave's special concoction. Another thing which Dave brought into the far north from the far south was a possum. Several times during the year, he would get in an opossum from the south and cook it for those who were either curious about it or really liked it. He knew how to cook this animal, which tastes very much like young roast pig when properly prepared. Dave Chambers was very much of a character around Grand Rapids and vicinity. He was always treated with great consideration, and he had many friends. He was a man of religious inclination. There was no Baptist church in Grand Rapids which he might attend, so he used to worship with the Presbyterians. On Sunday morning, he would rise and dress for the occasion, putting on a large white collar and a long-tailed black coat. On his head, he would place a tall stovepipe hat. Dressed in this fashion, he proceeded to the church, where he was always a conscientious listener and to which he was always a liberal contributor. So, yeah, that certainly is interesting. to have such food available in Grand Rapids, and he certainly does sound like a most interesting person. And sticking with that theme of food for a moment, here is the Thanksgiving menu, November 26, 1896, from the Hotel Pokegama, Dan Gunn, proprietor. The soup was bisque of oysters or tomato consomme, and that was served with Kalamazoo celery. Fish was planked whitefish with Saratoga chips. Now, that's interesting. Saratoga chips were a new invention of the time. Potato chips started in New York, and here they are already in Grand Rapids, right up to date in 1900. The meat available was boiled sugar-cured ham, sliced tongue with either wine sauce or tomato sauce, roast prime of beef, young turkey, mountain goat with Spanish dressing. Relishes included queen olives, cranberry sauce, and tomato pickles, Worcestershire sauce, Snyder's tomato ketchup, and salad dressing available. Vegetables included boiled potatoes, mashed potatoes, baked sweet potatoes, mashed turnips, French peas, entrees, macaroni and cheese, baked pork and beans, dessert, Boston cream puffs, English plum pudding with brandy sauce, apple pie, mince pie, pumpkin pie, creme de violette ice cream, American cheese, fruitcake, and grapes, apples, and oranges, French drip coffee, hot chocolate, or English breakfast tea. So what a varied and intriguing wide menu that was. And one more on cooks and cooking in kitchens in Grand Rapids. Many of the camp cooks were quick or ill-tempered. That is due to the fact that they always had to work so rapidly. As a group, they were also inclined to become somewhat arbitrary, and the fact that they were so useful and so much in demand tended to make some of them too independent for comfort. It is probably true that camp cooks drank more whiskey than the average citizen. Once, one who was drunk on the job was locked up in the root house. That was unfortunate because that was where the cook had planted his liquor. When they let him out a day later, he was drunker than ever, and thereafter went by the name of Root House Pete. And next time we'll look at some more of Rossman's stories.